Uma Abedin, who was Clinton's assistant. Wiener was being investigated on unrelated matters. The FBI assigned additional personnel to deal with the new discovery quickly, and Comey wrote the members of the Congress again on November 6th, just 2 days before the election, and reaffirmed his judgment that no prosecution was warranted. This suspenseful sequence of events assured that Comey's conduct was almost universally criticized by both sides in what everyone now conceded was a close election, though a Clinton victory was still generally anticipated. The New York Times estimated the chances of a Clinton victory at 92%, the Huffington Post at 98%. Comey, having alienated everyone as he sought the limelight, had one more mighty turn as a starring political celebrity, and America would not have long to wait for it. The Democrats believed that there was no reason to justify an additional public statement, as the new emails were deemed inconsequential. The Republicans thought Comey had done the minimum to maintain any credibility of a thorough investigation, but had reopened and again closed the case in order to make his whitewash of Clinton, despite his heavy criticism of her conduct, as convincing as possible. As if he had conducted two thorough and separate investigations, producing the same exculpatory result, even though he acknowledged Clinton's conduct was blameworthy. Despite Comey's refusal to recommend prosecution, Mrs. Clinton's view in her election memoir was that she had been shivved three times by Jim Comey, counting his initial press conference and his reopening and closing of the investigation as three separate affronts. The campaign went to the last day with the storm of countercharges reaching a cacophonous peak. Election Day was November 8, 2016. The campaign was a mere appetizer compared to the results. I had the good fortune to be one of a few color commentators who lasted the whole evening from 7 p.m. to the end at 3:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday on the principal Canadian television network CTV. Adrian Batra, the peppy young editor of the Toronto Sun, and I were among the very few in Canada or the United States who called it a 50-50 race with a slight advantage to Trump. The Sunday before, I had been the token non-anti-Trumper on my friend Fareed Zakaria's CNN program, GPS, for Global Public Square. It was like a Clinton cheerleaders rehearsal with a dissonant voice allowed solely in deference to the minimal requirements of pluralism. I was part of a panel made up entirely of Democrats, led in articulate fervor by the Obama-philic editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. Immediately prior to our discussion, we listened to a surrealistic debate between two pollsters about whether Mrs. Clinton's victory 2 days later would be by 5% or 7% of the total vote. This, it struck me, was an irrelevant conversation, because American presidential elections are not won by total vote counts. While Clinton would obviously rack up tremendous majorities in liberal states where Trump did not campaign, namely California, New York, and Illinois, Trump would, it seemed to me, likely win an adequate number of other states, many by narrow majorities, to carry the Electoral College. The winner in almost every state takes all that state's electoral votes, no matter how narrow the margin. I had the impression from the primaries that the chief polling organizations were sampling a model of voters that did not account for the large numbers of Archie Bunker, irate, blue-collar deplorables, as Mrs. Clinton had called them. Clinton was the candidate of continuity, of a broad, liberal, Bush-Clinton-Bush-Obama consensus that had governed Washington since the departure of Ronald Reagan. Trump, jarring and erratic though he often was, represented the rejection of that liberal consensus. He was the champion of those who felt they were losing their country to elites who did not share their values and their patriotism, and of those who had been disappointed and left out from the benefits of a globalism that favored transnational elites and foreign or illegal immigrant workers, in their view, over American blue-collar workers. The opposition of the political establishments of both parties, and of the media, and of the functionaries, including the academic ones, of the sloppy, shabby, bumbling, and discredited cadres of the old order, these voters regarded as a badge of honor for the formidable, if often outlandish, Republican contender. Many would feel, as I did, a foreigner, what Franklin D. Roosevelt said of his ostensible mentor but later rival, Alfred E. Smith, FDR's predecessor as governor of New York and a Democratic presidential nominee. I loved him for his enemies. I know the Clintons also, especially President Clinton, and have always found them very intelligent and unfailingly courteous. But they had had their turn, and Mrs. Clinton's campaign was unimpressive. These were my views as the evening began. Kentucky and Indiana reported first and gave heavy majorities to Trump, the anticipated result. But if any credence had been attached to the Trump smear scare, his lead would have been narrower even in those normally Republican states. His majority in the two states was almost 1 million votes. There was not a ripple in the ranks of my fellow panelists, who, apart from the Sun editor, were uniformly dismissive of Trump's candidacy, including my old friend Lloyd Robertson, Canada's senior news anchor, gracious and mellifluous as he had been on the country's airwaves for more than 50 years. We all had a break for 15 minutes or so each hour to stretch, eat pizza, drink coffee, and watch all the other networks on screens in the green room. Trump led all night. The early confident assertions of the imminent emergence of the great Clinton invincibility slowly faded into a tense acknowledgement that it was a very close election. In monitoring the American networks, I saw my former employee at the Jerusalem Post, Wolf Blitzer, as he scrambled like an asphyxiated roach between electoral maps in the CNN newsroom, desperately trying to unearth a thread of plausible data that would conduct Hillary Clinton to the White House. The expectation of an inevitable Clinton victory slowly, excruciatingly shut down. The people had spoken, but had not followed the script that had been handed to them. My fellow panelists, some of whom were rabidly partisan, but in every case very civil and pleasant, and for the most part only so partisan because they had bought the media and Democratic line that Donald was a madman, a degenerate, and a crook of the first water, became rather dejected at around midnight, as Trump still led, and the big battleground states had all gone Republican. These were the supposedly knife-edge contests in Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio, which Trump won by respectively 113,000 votes, 173,000 votes, and 447,000 votes, despite the lack of Ohio Governor Kasich's endorsement of his party's nominee. I felt moved to tell my fellow commentators on camera and in complete sincerity that they should not be such defeatists, that the result was uncertain, and that their faith in a one-sided victory had been misplaced, but that the result was still a toss-up. Trump was leading, but it all depended now on Michigan, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. All but New Hampshire, only 4 electoral votes, had been assumed to be safe for Clinton, including by Mrs. Clinton herself. And as we progressed wearily past 1 a.m., these states were deemed too close to call, though Trump was leading in Michigan and Wisconsin. As the world awaited the results from the key states, the analysis on all the networks turned from a sniggering mood of participating in a Clinton coronation to a much more serious, not to mention panicked, discussion of what might actually happen. The discomfiture of poor Blitzer, the greediest employee I ever had, and among thousands of journalists, that was a signal distinction, and his fellow liberal hysterics across the networks and cable news channels, was palpable and almost oppressive, though gratifying. At 2 a.m., when asked by my co-chairperson, as the senior champion of Trump's possibilities from many hours before, to give my prediction, I said that I had never thought Trump could win Michigan, and still did not, and that I was astounded by Wisconsin, which had not voted for a Republican in a presidential election since Ronald Reagan. But with Trump leading by 85,000 votes with 93% of the ballots counted, unless the uncounted ballots were all from the African-American districts of Milwaukee, he seemed likely to win that state. In Pennsylvania, I had always thought Trump an underdog, and I thought the election as a whole, and the election in Pennsylvania in particular, was in doubt, though as the ballots kept getting counted in Pennsylvania, Clinton's early lead was steadily diminishing. As I was winding up this studious effort at absolute impartiality, One of the technicians, when the camera was on the panel, came forward and pointed at the electoral vote totals that now had flipped Wisconsin to the Republican candidate and showed Trump at 275 electoral votes, five more than needed for a majority, and that he was now the president-elect. After 3 minutes, as no one had picked up on this, though the technician was waving his arms about as if he was directing the landing of torpedo bombers on the flight deck of a storm-tossed aircraft carrier, I gently suggested that the election result appeared to have been determined. Wonder and incredulity contested for mastery in the reactions of everyone on all the networks, even up to a point myself. Between 2:30 and 2:45 a.m., all the main networks and news agencies declared Donald Trump the next president of the United States. Mrs. Clinton's campaign manager, the hypercombative John Podesta, came out to speak in the candidate's place and said she would speak later in the morning and for everyone to go home. He did not comment on the outcome of the election or acknowledge that it was clear Trump had won. Donald Trump and his family and chief political collaborators, already swaddled in the vast apparatus of the U.S. presidency, proceeded in an immense motorcade the several blocks from the Trump Tower to the New York Republican election headquarters at the New York Hilton. As the winning candidate was about to address the country, I whispered to Lloyd Robertson, quoting Monty Python, now for something completely different. Donald Trump spoke with exquisite tact and magnanimity at 3:15 a.m., gave no hint that he was surprised by the result, and said he had had a gracious call from Mrs. Clinton. He promised to try to encompass the wishes and ambitions of all Americans. He acknowledged that it had been a complicated campaign and urged a spirit of civility. To all Republicans and all Democrats and independents, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. When the full vote was in, it was clear how close the election was and how astutely Trump had exploited the vagaries of the Electoral College system. The final vote would be 65,853,516 for Clinton to 62,984,825 for Trump, to 4,489,000 for the Libertarian Gary Johnson, 1,457,000 for the Green candidate, Jill Stein, and 732,000 for the Utah independent, Evan McMullen. If it had been a quest for the highest number of votes, as in a French presidential election, Trump would have campaigned in California, New York, and Illinois and narrowed the gap. If there had been a runoff between the top two candidates to obtain a majority, as there is in France, Trump would have taken most of the Libertarians and Independents, and Clinton most of the Greens, but Trump would probably have won anyway. Illustrative of the Clintons' decline, all polls confirmed that Trump won the white women's vote. There were unusually wide disparities in the individual states. 14 states and the District of Columbia cast more than 60% of their votes for one or other of the candidates. Trump crossed this threshold in Alabama, Arkansas, Kentucky, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, where his lead was 653,000 votes, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Clinton took more than 60% of the votes in California, a lead of 4.25 million voters, an astounding statewide victory, the margin of which alone amounted for more than her lead in the popular vote nationally. Hawaii, Maryland, 735,000 lead, Massachusetts, 905,000 lead, and the District of Columbia. Trump, in his railings against big government, the lobbyists, and the national media, had run against the interests of almost every adult resident of Washington, D.C. Even allowing for that, Clinton won the district's three electoral votes by the unheard-of margin of 282,830, 90.5%, to 12,732, 4.1%. In other words, counting third-party candidates, the nation's capital voted 96% against its incoming president. In Illinois and Indiana, neighbors by geography but not by politics, Clinton carried the larger Illinois by 945,000 votes, 56%, and Trump took Indiana by 525,000 votes, 57%. In the home state of both candidates, New York, Hillary Clinton led by 1.73 million votes, 59%. Trump's biggest plurality in terms of sheer numbers of votes was in Texas, where the margin was 808,000 votes, 52% for Trump, 43% for Clinton. And the narrowest race was in New Hampshire, where Clinton finally won by 3,200 votes, a margin of less than half of 1%. In the states where the election was won, Trump took Michigan by 11,000 votes, barely a fifth of 1% of the total, Pennsylvania by 46,000 votes, 0.7%, and Wisconsin by 23,000 votes, 0.77%. These states have, respectively, 16, 20, and 10 electoral votes, and Trump, with all other results unchanged, needed one of the three to win. A shift of just 40,000 votes between the three would have won for Clinton in an election where nearly 137 million people voted. On the other hand, even if those 40,000 votes had changed in Clinton's favor, if 16,000 people had voted for Trump instead of Clinton in Nevada and New Hampshire, Trump would have won those states and would still have won the election, 270 electoral votes to 268. Trump won 30 states and the second elector in Maine, and Clinton won 20 states and the District of Columbia. The turnout was about 55.5% of those eligible, but many Obama voters sat it out, and many previous non-voters came out for Trump. But it is impossible to be very precise about the size of these shifts. Substantial numbers of Latin American voters favored Trump, despite his comments on immigration, presumably because they had come to the country legally or their parents had, and they thought others should. The African American vote, understandably, fell well short as a percentage and in absolute numbers for Clinton compared to what it had been for Obama. After a slight shuffling of individual electors, Trump was elected by 304 members of the Electoral College to 227 for Clinton, with seven other votes cast for people who had not contested the election. Trump was tactically astute in where and how he campaigned, but he was also lucky. It is hard not to sympathize to some degree with Hillary Clinton. Unlike her husband, Mrs. Clinton was an infelicitous candidate. She had exactly tied the primaries against Barack Obama in 2008, but was denied the nomination by the ex officio superdelegates. And though in 2016 she turned these tables on Bernie Sanders to some degree, she was again denied victory after winning the popular vote in the election, and was only the sixth candidate in United States history to have achieved that dubious distinction, though she won the popular vote by a larger margin than any of the five such previous defeated nominees, which made it all the more disappointing or infuriating. Trump, however, could claim the distinction not only of winning the election, but of winning more votes than any previous Republican candidate for president. It was also impossible to withhold from Trump the credit for such a stunning and unprecedented upset. With nothing but his own ingenuity, intuition, and stamina, and not even much of an investment of his large personal fortune, he spent less than 7% of what the Koch brothers did supporting their approved candidates. He became the oldest in a first election and wealthiest victorious presidential candidate, and the only one never to have held or sought a public position of public service, civil or military. The Republicans, also contrary to predictions, retained control of both houses of the Congress, but only by 52 to 48 in the Senate. And Trump was not popular with the majority of Republican legislators, whom he had severely criticized for being wobbly and ineffectual. Reasonable criticisms, as the coming months would confirm. Among other developments, populism had triumphed. If any Bush, Clinton, or Obama is heard from as a coming candidate for the presidency again, it will be on a straight meritocratic basis and after the appropriate interval when spurs are won and the country is exposed to other families, the old-fashioned way, as it was for the Adamses, Harrisons, and Roosevelts. What occurred was the supreme triumph of populism in American history and in the modern democratic world. Even Andrew Jackson had been a prominent general, albeit in Gilbert and Sullivan wars, and in crushing the natives almost as brutally as Mussolini did the Ethiopians. And he had briefly been a senator and congressman, and ran once and was the leading vote-getter in a four-way race before he was elected president. Politically, Trump came from nowhere. Among the great Western nations, only the traditional republics of the United States and France have the constitutional and psychological ability to conduct a full national exercise in populism with previously untested candidates. Some of the criticism of this election as demagogy was justified on both sides, though not the charge of mob rule leveled against Trump by the Democrats. In 2016, populism was the only avenue to national renovation for America, as it probably was in 2017 for France, when that country elected a political newcomer as president and a new party to predominate in the National Assembly. The election of Donald Trump electrified the world and stunned the American political community, which had never imagined such a turn of events to be possible. And when the outcome was announced, economists, with all the weather forecasting skills for which they are so notorious, immediately went on many of the networks predicting a stock market crash. In reality, in Tokyo, Singapore, Sydney, and Hong Kong, where the stock exchanges were already open, there were sharp upward moves. The London Stock Exchange, the second most important in the world, rose all day. The continental European exchanges advanced in lockstep, and when New York opened, it delivered a powerful vote of approval to the voters' choice. Though Trump had never been a favorite in Wall Street, nor had he much use for its services or, with a few exceptions, regard for its leading figures. Nevertheless, the American stock rally that began on news of his election would take the stock market to ever more record-breaking highs through his first year in office. Among those stunned by this reality have been the writers and editors of The Economist, who have been hysterically hostile to Trump since he first surfaced as a contender and have remained so, serving as yet another exemplary illustration of how intelligent people on the subject of Trump have simply lost their minds. The stupefaction of reeling American liberals soon transmogrified into denial, clinical depression, demonic demonstrative activism, blood-curdling threats of civil disobedience and obstruction, and even the guerrilla resistance of violent self-styled anti-fascists, or Antifa. The left had not imagined it necessary to compose any contingency plans in case of defeat. And now, shattered and fragmented, it turned to the streets, to round-the-clock denunciations of Trump on cable news channels like CNN and MSNBC, and to daily editorial barrages on nearly every page of The Washington Post and The New York Times, both of which took the absurd position that the defeat of their favored candidate meant that American democracy was now endangered. Protest demonstrations arose almost spontaneously in New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, Oakland, Philadelphia, and Seattle, and the next day in Portland, Oregon, where violent window smashing and petty vandalism by semi-professional urban guerrillas in ninja outfits continued for several days. Women purporting to wear elaborate headgear intended to simulate vaginas demonstrated in Washington. Madonna, who had so recently offered her physical favors almost indiscriminately, announced to cheers that she had thought of blowing up the White House, presumably after the Obamas had departed it. To the liberal media, which had just received a stunning rebuff in the election, and to the generally somewhat resentful anti-American world, the whole future of humanity was put in doubt by the election of this raving and garish buffoon who was unqualified to be and should not be president. On November 10th, Will Ron of CBS Digital put up a piece called The Unbearable Smugness of the Media, in which he chastised his colleagues in the press for failing to notice the strength of the Trump movement and for subscribing to the Clinton view that Trump supporters were just a bunch of louts and failures. He correctly predicted that the media's reaction to Trump's victory would not be self-reflection that they had failed in their professional duty to cover the story fairly. Instead, they would conclude that there were more louts in the country than they had realized. Trump called on President Obama at the White House on November 10th, and they had a cordial chat. 4 days later, Obama urged the country to give Trump a chance. The day before Obama's common sense appeal, the New York Times, in a letter to subscribers signed by the publisher and the editor and instantly reprinted all over the media, acknowledged that Donald Trump's sheer unconventionality led us and other news outlets to underestimate his support among American voters. The Times had been irrationally hostile from the start and has continued to be so, without interruption by a single noteworthy pro-Trump story. Trump referred to the paper as the failing New York Times throughout the campaign because of its poor financial results and stock price, and the fact that it had issued junk bonds to Mexican mega-billionaire Carlos Slim to make up operating and capital losses. Trump tried to improve the media and political atmosphere by granting an interview to the Wall Street Journal, which, after overcoming its initial skepticism, had become more supportive as the campaign wore on. As an olive branch to Democrats, he hinted that he would be prepared to keep parts of Obamacare. In an interview on November 13th with the CBS show 60 Minutes, Trump again tried to conciliate Democrats, saying that when it came to illegal immigration, his focus would be on deporting illegal migrants who had been convicted of crimes, which he estimated at 2 to 3 million people, and that as long as the border was secured, he envisioned a normalization procedure for the other 8 to 9 million people who had entered the country illegally. The media, in what must be considered an outright act of collective dishonesty, purported to regard this as a proposal to expel 2 to 3 million innocent people while allowing the rest to be normalized. There were, within a few days, completely unfounded but widespread media reports of chaos in the effort to recruit White House staff for the incoming president. In fact, in short order, Reince Priebus was appointed White House Chief of Staff, and the controversial populist intellectual Steve Bannon was designated Chief Strategist on November 14th. On November 17th, Trump proposed that lobbying be prohibited for 5 years after leaving office, rudely interrupting the notorious Washington practice of people going directly from government into intensive lobbying of their former workmates, dishing out government patronage. The next day, clearing away a significant irritant, he settled all the Trump University lawsuits for $25 million. He now had much more important work than dabbling in such indignities. The vice president-elect, Mike Pence, who had conducted a very effective campaign and undoubtedly won his debate with his Democratic opponent, Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, was booed and harassed by the audience and even the cast at a performance of the musical Hamilton in New York. This was a startling indication of the poisoned political atmosphere in the country. There would be no honeymoon period for the new administration. Indeed, the left took the position that there should be no tolerance or respect for the incoming president and his administration at all. On November 22nd, Trump told a meeting with reporters and editors of the failing New York Times that he did not want to energize the so-called alt-right, which had become a portmanteau for the extreme right, though that had not been its original meaning, and that I disavow this group. Between November 18th and December 16th, in a very well-organized flow of plausible and respected candidates for key positions, Trump and his transition team announced his selections for key administrative positions. His nominees included Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama and Trump's principal early supporter in the Congress, for attorney general. Betsy DeVos, a well-known supporter of charter schools, for education secretary. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for Ambassador to the United Nations. Congressman Tom Price, a doctor, for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Elaine Chao, wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and a member of the last Bush cabinet, for Secretary of Transportation. Steve Mnuchin of Wall Street and the film financing industry, hardly hotbeds of Trump supporters, for Secretary of the Treasury. Marine General James Mattis for Secretary of Defense, primary opponent Dr. Ben Carson as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, environmental anti-alarmist Scott Pruitt for Director of the Environmental Protection Agency, Exxon Chief Executive Rex W. Tillerson for Secretary of State, former Texas Governor Rick Perry for Secretary of Energy, Montana Congressman and former Navy SEAL Ryan Zinke for Secretary of the Interior, Linda McMahon, wife of Trump's old world wrestling sidekick Vince McMahon for head of the Small Business Administration, Marine General John Kelly for Homeland Security Secretary, and Congressman Mick Mulvaney for Director of Management and Budget. In January, but before the inauguration, former Indiana Senator Dan Coats was named Director of the National Intelligence Agency. Congressman Mike Pompeo was chosen to head the CIA. Dr. David Shulkin was nominated to lead Veterans Affairs, and former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue was nominated as Secretary of Agriculture. All of these nominees were eventually confirmed, but McConnell wasn't hurrying, and the Democrats were slowing the process unreasonably. It was legislative guerrilla warfare already. DeVos, as a champion of charter schools and an enemy of the teachers' unions, was attacked by all Democrats and some Republicans. Sessions was fiercely attacked by the Democrats' Senate leader, Chuck Schumer, for allegedly being insufficiently sensitive to civil rights issues when Sessions had been a U.S. attorney in Alabama 25 years before. Schumer announced a policy of endless obstruction, and his party backed him. Vice President Pence had to cast the deciding vote in a 50-50 tie to secure the DeVos nomination. And Sessions, despite many years in the Senate, got no Democratic votes. Never Trump Republicans and Democrats, forming themselves into the loosely organized resistance, collaborated to try to prevent Trump's installation as president by instigating a rebellion among the Electoral College electors. In an op-ed in the Washington Post, Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig called on the Trump-pledged members of the Electoral College to break their pledges and deny Trump a majority, thus pushing the election to the House of Representatives. The House had chosen the president three times before, selecting Thomas Jefferson over Aaron Burr in 1800, John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson in 1824, and Rutherford Hayes over Samuel Tilden in 1876. But this was an extraordinary proposal to make in 2017, though Trump would almost certainly have won such a referral. The following day, Jill Stein, candidate of the Green Party, having rummaged together the $5 million necessary, it was widely suspected that a considerable part of it came from the Clinton campaign, funded the challenge of the election vote in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin recount was completed on December 13th and increased Trump's lead in that state by 131 votes. The Democrats, meanwhile, took out television advertisements in an attempt to convince Trump's pledged electors that the Republic needed them to desert Trump for Clinton, or perhaps Kasich. This was a manifestation of insanity in terms of the ratio between cost and effectiveness. An initial $500,000 was spent by a Democratic Party front called Unite for America, which was composed largely of washed-up actors. Seven Electoral College members did switch their votes, but five departed Hillary, and only two quit Trump. The seven new choices made were three for General Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, and one each for Ohio Governor John Kasich, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Faith Spotted Eagle of the Yankton Sioux. The never-Trumpers and resistance would prove as tenacious as they were numerous, but their opening gambits were desperate fiascos. Before he had invited Tillerson to be Secretary of State, Trump had an amiable meeting with former outspoken critic Mitt Romney, and there was allegedly some suggestion of Romney assuming that position. The cordiality between the two men continued after this. Trump had received congratulations from most world leaders, though very guardedly phrased in the case of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who spoke anxiously of some of Trump's campaign confrontations being difficult to bear. The German Justice Minister, Heiko Maas, said, "The world won't end, but things will get more crazy." French President François Hollande, in the last few months of his term, with approval figures in single digits in most polls of the French electorate, histrionically announced that France would need to be strong in the face of an upcoming period of uncertainty, and scaled the heights of French ponderousness. What is at stake is peace, the fight against terrorism, the Middle East, and the preservation of the planet. The British, Canadian, and Australian leaders were correctly cordial, and some authoritarian leaders, especially China's Xi Jinping, Russia's Vladimir Putin, and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, were more upbeat. The media adhered to its now well-entrenched practice of magnifying anything they could present as a miscue by Trump, as a luridly immense faux pas that would shake his credibility to its feeble foundations. Thus, when he telephoned the president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, on December 3rd, the American media, which knows almost nothing about China and has to consult specialists to explain anything beyond Chinese government press releases, concluded that Trump was guilty of a diplomatic blunder. It was soon clear that relations with China were good, and that the Taiwan call was not controversial, as relations with that country afforded the United States some leverage on the People's Republic. As the interregnum between the election and the inauguration unfolded, Trump, often with Vice President-elect Mike Pence in tow, pursued companies that had announced they were going to close plants in the United States and relocate to countries where it was cheaper to do business. The Carrier Corporation, manufacturer of air conditioners, had made such an announcement about a plant in Indiana, where Pence was still acting governor. And Trump and Pence held a press conference on December 1st to announce that they would discourage Carrier from such a move, and eventually an arrangement was made canceling the plant closure. Trump was very active in this area, and on December 6th was able to announce that Japanese businessman Masayoshi Son had pledged a $50 billion investment and the creation of 50,000 new jobs in the United States. On the same day, Trump successfully demanded a serious reduction in the cost of a new Air Force One presidential aircraft. It briefly affected the Boeing stock price negatively. On December 14th, almost as if he were already president, Trump met with Silicon Valley CEOs to discuss opportunities to increase domestic high-tech manufacturing and to create an environment for innovation in America. On December 28th, Trump was able to announce that other corporations would be creating 8,000 new jobs. There was a terrorist attack on the Berlin Christmas market on December 19th that killed 12 and injured 56. The terrorist, a failed Tunisian asylum seeker, was killed in a police shootout in Milan a few days later. Trump called the terrorist outrage an attack on all humanity, and when questioned about banning the entry into the United States of Muslims, Trump responded that he believed his plans were correct and would be made explicit soon after he was in office. Trump's domestic enemies, however, were already planning legal challenges to whatever he might impose on grounds of unconstitutional discrimination against a religious group, which they attempted to prove by using Trump campaign rhetoric. This would not be the last lesson the incoming president would need to learn about the hazards of imprecise language leavened by truthful hyperbole. On December 23rd, Obama had his ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, abstain from a United Nations Security Council vote on a resolution that demanded a halt to Israeli settlements in the so-called occupied territories, captured during the 1967 Six-Day War. The resolution further declared that Israeli possession of the Western Wall, the Hebrew University and Hadassah Hospital on Mount Scopus, and the Jewish Quarter of Jerusalem was a flagrant violation of international law. This abstention was a final act of frustration from Obama that he had made no progress in advancing peace in the Middle East in his 8 years as president, a failure he blamed on Israeli intractability. Trump issued a statement advising Israel to stay strong. It will be different when we take office. He dismissed the United Nations as a social club and talking shop for despots and human rights violators of little use to anyone but those who profit from its corruption. Donald and Melania received great applause from their fellow congregants at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, where they had been married almost 13 years before when they attended a Christmas Eve service there. As the new year approached, Trump's opponents were resigned to his taking office, but not to providing the least measure of cooperation to enable him to be successful. On January 8th, the distinguished actress Meryl Streep gave the Golden Globe Awards night an anti-Trump tirade, with the usual insinuations that Trump was a racist and a sexist. Trump inevitably responded, saying that Streep was a Hillary flunky who has lost big. This was fair enough, but he showed his somewhat churlish and even juvenile side by also calling her one of the most overrated actresses in Hollywood. If he had said she was merely an actress, that would have been possibly effective as snobbery. But it was unwise and not well received for him to imply that even as an actress she was not very talented. It was the wrong type of response from a person about to be inducted into the presidency of the United States. He could now and needed now to rise above most of this malice, which was usually completely uninformed, as Streep's allegations were. He would spend the next year struggling with a steep learning curve about how American presidents should behave and how to rely on the dignity lent by the office. In the last 10 days before he was inaugurated, the intensity of the fear, anger, and hostility of his enemies, who a year before had been doubling over laughing at the very mention of a Trump candidacy, became sharper and more destructive. The appointment of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as a senior advisor was denounced by most of the media as rank nepotism, and Kushner was gratuitously portrayed as completely unqualified to do anything around the White House except empty wastebaskets. Kushner proved to be smarter than his critics, and suggestions that such an appointment might be illegal were nonsense, as were suggestions that Kushner's wife, Ivanka Trump, not be allowed to act as an advisor to her father. The biggest shoes dropped on January 10th, when CNN breathlessly reported on a story that no respectable news site was willing to touch until then, the so-called Steele dossier, compiled by a former British intelligence officer, but for parties that were not immediately identified and for motives that were not at first clear. The Steele dossier had been out on BuzzFeed, a pretty scurrilous and rabidly partisan website. It wouldn't accept advertising from Republicans, but serious journalists had ignored it because of its lurid and improbable nature. CNN, however, not only took the bait, but Wolf Blitzer ran about his Situation Room like Groucho Marx, bent forward in his hurry to get to his next graphic, and exclaiming ad nauseum about the enterprise that had been required to produce this triumph of investigative journalism. The bedraggled old greaser Carl Bernstein, co-author with Bob Woodward of The Destruction of Richard Nixon, and always a questionable source of information, was disentombed from his dust-accumulating obscurity to declare this malicious drivel very significant and potentially extremely damaging to the president-elect. His co-assailant Woodward rather more scrupulously called the dossier a garbage document, and FBI Director James Comey in due course called it salacious and unverifiable. Though responsible media had passed on this document for months, now that a semi-respectable organization had put it out, the rest of the media was happy to cite it as a CNN story without opining on how much credence should be attached to it. The most bizarre of the many fabrications in it was that Trump had organized for a group of prostitutes to urinate in a hotel bed in Moscow, because the Obamas had once slept in it. This entered American presidential history as the Golden Shower. In getting into this, the Democrats and their media allies took on much more than they had imagined. It eventually emerged that the dossier had been commissioned by Fusion GPS, a commercial and political espionage and special service company that generally works for the Democrats, and had been extensively patronized by the Clintons. Further very damaging information about it came within a few months, but it was a very dubious source from the beginning. Trump coined the phrase fake news for documents such as this and denounced it in terms that, though vituperative, were for once not excessive. It is hard, even for a close observer of the febrile political atmosphere of the time, to imagine what possessed anyone to touch this stink bomb. The story behind it would soon become much more astonishing and besmirch its sponsors and propagators. Also on January 10th, in words that would have extensive consequences, Senator Sessions, as Attorney General designate, told the Senate Judiciary Committee that he had had no contact with the Russians during the campaign. These words of denial would soon be altered and would ramify widely if unfairly. Trump's enemies were already placing their bets on the Russian card for destroying his presidency, however wildly improbable that card was. Trump had finally been acknowledged as the winner of the election, but he had not won the normal deference that is given a new president. The war Trump had unleashed on the entire political establishment continued. Congressman John Lewis of Georgia, a former civil rights activist, provided a brief glimpse of what was about to come. On January 14th, Lewis said the election result was illegitimate. Trump said Lewis should deal with his own congressional district, which Trump virtually described as a crime-infested rubble heap. A few days later, wildly irresponsible California Congresswoman Maxine Waters called for Trump's impeachment, and under media questioning said the cause for impeaching him would be turned up by the Russia investigation. For the next year, at least, she regaled the after-dinner circuit and greatly supplemented her income with the chant, "Impeach 45. Trump is the 45th president, when, as is the odd practice, Grover Cleveland's two non-consecutive terms are counted as two presidents. The less publicized toilers in the Democratic Washington boiler rooms were working feverishly on plans for a guerrilla war to undermine, immobilize, and, if possible, destroy his presidency. Donald Trump would be president at last, but of a severely divided country and of a fractured political system. He had the great office, but was surrounded by enemies, many of them in his own party. It was both great and tawdry drama, a mighty epic, many of whose protagonists were not very galvanizing personalities. The American people were both the prize and the prize giver, and they prepared for an inauguration unlike any other. What Franklin D. Roosevelt called, in reference to his own first presidential inauguration, a day of national consecration, was at hand, but it would be the starting pistol for a second, almost bloodless American Civil War. Chapter 10. President at Last. In his inaugural address, President Trump greeted four previous presidents behind him on the podium: Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, and thanked the Obamas for their gracious and magnificent help throughout the transition. What followed was a rather strained proclamation of unprecedented change. "Today, we are not merely transferring power from one administration to another or from one party to another, but we are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the American people. For too long, a small group in the nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost. Washington flourished, but the people did not share in its wealth. Politicians prospered, but the jobs left and the factories closed. The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of the country. January 20th, 2017 will be remembered as the day the people became rulers of the country again." This was a rather stern reproof of his four predecessors sitting nearby, who had occupied the White House for 28 years. It was not calculated to attract the accolades of the Congress, most of the members of which were also present and were among the accused. According to Hillary Clinton's memoir, which purported to explain why it had been Trump and not her addressing the crowd on the National Mall, George W. Bush offered this blunt assessment of Trump's speech: "That was some weird shit." Returning to a more uncontroversial version of Trumpian truthful hyperbole, he said to the country, "You came by the tens of millions to become part of a historic movement the likes of which the world has never seen before." He was referring to mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation, an education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of knowledge, and the crime and drugs and gangs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. We've made other countries rich, while the wealth, strength, and confidence of our country has disappeared over the horizon. One by one, the factories shuttered and left our shores with not even a thought about the millions upon millions of American workers left behind. The wealth of our middle class has been ripped from their homes and then redistributed across the entire world. This was essentially a campaign speech, although the campaign had ended 10 weeks before, and the campaign before him now was to get the legislation to enact his proposals through a Congress that was only marginally different from the one that had co-authored the dark age of recent years he was, with a dosage of his notorious hyperbole, describing. But the president of just 5 minutes promised, "America will start winning again, winning like never before. We will bring back our jobs. We will bring back our borders. We will bring back our wealth. And we will bring back our dreams. We will build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. We will get our people off of welfare and back to work, rebuilding our country with American hands and American labor. We will be protected by the great men and women of our military and law enforcement, and most importantly, we are protected by God." This was taking a lot on himself, but a new national pride will stir our souls, lift our sights, and heal our divisions. It is time to remember that old wisdom our soldiers never forget, that whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots. We all enjoy the same glorious freedoms, and we all salute the same glorious American flag. And whether a child is born in the urban sprawl of Detroit or the windswept plains of Nebraska, they look up at the same night sky, they fill their heart with the same dreams, and they are infused with the breath of life by the same mighty Creator. So to all Americans in every city, near and far, small and large, from mountain to mountain and from ocean to ocean, hear these words. You will never be ignored again. Your voice, your hopes, and your dreams will define our American destiny. And your courage and goodness and love will forever guide us along the way. He closed with, "Together we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again, and yes, together we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America." He could not possibly deliver quickly on such promises. The response of his own party's congressional delegation was bound to be muted and ambivalent, which would make any such jolting change as he pledged especially difficult. He had not swept into office like Roosevelt in 1933 with an almost unlimited mandate for change from a desperate country, or even like Reagan in 1981 with a clear enough mandate to reduce taxes and increase defense spending. Trump had never been too precise about how he was going to address the evils he denounced, apart from stopping illegal immigration with stricter border controls, including a wall, deporting some illegal immigrants already in the country, renegotiating trade deals that generated large trade deficits for the United States and eliminated American manufacturing jobs, and taking a tougher line with North Korea and Iran. The key to advancing his goals now was not continuing to lash the remnants of the political establishment who were digging in. The Democrats, anti-Trump Republicans, who might well have included House Speaker Ryan and Senate Leader McConnell, the national media and the entire entertainment industry were still at war with Trump. The inauguration of the new president had not had a halcyon effect on American public and media opinion about him. Speaking at CIA headquarters the next day, he betrayed the absurd hypersensitivity that sometimes accompanies Trump's rhinoceros hide. He objected to public estimates that there were only 250,000 people at his inauguration and parade. Given that 96% of the District of Columbia had voted against him, and that it was well publicized that mobs of vandals would be protesting his inauguration, it was miraculous that he had any such large gathering of supporters. But the president took it upon himself to tell the CIA personnel, who cannot possibly have had the slightest interest and must have been nonplussed that the subject was raised, that it was 1.5 million people who had attended his inauguration, He had his press secretary, Sean Spicer, labor through his first press conference making and defending the proposition that the inauguration crowd the day before was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, both in person and around the globe. Technically, this gave the president an escape hatch, as no one had any idea how many people around the world or even across the United States had witnessed it. But that had not been the source of the controversy, which was Trump's opponents scoffing at the physical turnout. This was what Kellyanne Conway had in mind the following day when she referred to alternate facts. Estimates of the Trump crowd went as high as 600,000. It was, in any case, a formidable turnout, but substantially less than Obama's at his first inauguration. There had been some disorderly behavior around the parade the day before, but this was the merest foretaste of the large demonstration that took place in Washington and in other cities and countries while the president was addressing the Central Intelligence Agency. It was a cry of anguish and vengeance from a vintage coalition of the left, Planned Parenthood, the Natural Resources Defense Council, AFL-CIO, Amnesty International, National Center for Lesbian Rights, National Organization for Women, MoveOn.org, Human Rights Watch, the American Indian Movement, Greenpeace, and many others. Anti-abortion organizations that were otherwise supporters of the women's movement were at first admitted and then expelled from the coalition. Among the speakers to the 450,000 or so marchers in Washington were the inevitable Gloria Steinem, Scarlett Johansson, the venerable communist Angela Davis, Michael Moore, Cecily Richards, Ashley Judd, and Democratic Senators Tammy Duckworth and Kamala Harris. There were 408 marches in the United States and 198 in 84 other countries, all ignited by Trump's election and coming to the aid of every conceivable leftist cause, with particular emphasis on hostility to white males. Among those who participated in these marches in various places were Gillian Anderson, Alec Baldwin, Drew Barrymore, Beyoncé, Cher, Jessica Chastain, Jamie Lee Curtis, Miley Cyrus, Fran Drescher, Jane Fonda, Ariana Grande, Chelsea Handler, Blake Lively, Madonna, Helen Mirren, Julia Roberts, Chris Rock, Barbara Streisand, Charlize Theron, and Emma Watson. An additional feature of the marches were the pussy hats, hundreds of thousands of pink knitted toques with pointy ears like cats, to remind everyone of Trump's unfortunate comment from 11 years before. It was the usual unfocused broad coalition of whiners and faddists interspersed with extremists and heavy laden with Hollywood figures, satisfied that their celebrity entitled them to contend for direction of the country, even one day after the inauguration of the person who won the election. The speeches in Washington and as far afield as Perth, Australia, took their cue from Bruce Springsteen, who declared, "We are the new American resistance." There was no violence, but it was a monumental tableau of the idiocy and pretension of America's overindulged entertainment industry and the gullible naivete of many foreign analogs. The conservative movement in the United States fairly vocally accused the marchers of being infested with Islamists and other anti-Semites and of verging on anarchism in places. Various commentators said the marchers had a questionable right, professing to represent democracy while protesting the installation of a democratically elected leader of the United States. President Trump wisely ignored the entire orgy of raging exhibitionism. He was too busy, perhaps, working. He was a ball of fire from the opening bell of his inauguration, and left no doubt of his intention to move as quickly as he could to advance the policies he had promised. In his first 10 days in office, he withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which he promised throughout the campaign, claiming it would import unemployment to the United States. He ended the previous administration's policy of giving $600 million annually to assist abortions in foreign countries. He had a useful and cordial meeting with American labor leaders, who generally approved his pro-industrial employment policies, and many of whose workers had voted for Trump. He approved the Keystone XL and Dakota pipelines. He started strengthening security along the Mexican border, using unspent funds in the Homeland Security Department, and blocked federal grants to sanctuary cities, which declared they would not enforce American laws against illegal migrants. This issue was shortly mired in the court system. He had a successful meeting with the new British Prime Minister, Theresa May, and said a strong and independent Britain is a blessing to the world. Most controversially, he claimed widespread voter fraud, with many jurisdictions allegedly permitting illegal migrants to vote. The charge could not really be judged.